William Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Taylor Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. We hope you enjoyed our first podcast of 2017 and the new format where John and I will discuss various topics, and we also have one special guest. Our special guest today will be Richard Wassell, who has been on the show many times. He has broken rowing records around the world. If you remember, he had a stroke, so rows with one arm. But the good news is he's been selected for the Invictus Games, and so we're going to catch up with him and hear all about that. But anyway, there's plenty to talk about. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, the first thing I'm going to talk about in this show, John, is the fact that the FFA, their top officials, Stephen Lowy, the chairman, and CEO David Gallop, headed to Zurich to meet with the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, and also with the FIFA Secretary General Fatima Samba Diouf Samoura and some FIFA senior officials. Now, this upset a lot of the A-League clubs because they went over there. Now, what you have to remember is that the A-League clubs have been pushing for reform to the constitution of the FFA, and it was agreed on the 22nd of September 2016 that the FFA would liaise with the clubs. Then on the 12th of October, Mr. Gallop said he was committed to change, that the FFA were committed to change. Now, a statement that's come out following that meeting from the FFA says these 3 points. FFA and FIFA held constructive discussions regarding the process of expanding the membership of its Congress in Australia, which would allow for a broader representation of stakeholders. So just remember that, a broader representation of stakeholders. The FFA indicated its intention to hold further discussions with stakeholders, including member federations, A-League clubs, and the PFA, in coming weeks, with a view to implementing membership changes through an extraordinary general meeting of its members to be held by the end of March. An EGM will need to be held in order that existing members can consider a special resolution to amend the constitution of FFA based on the outcome of the stakeholders' consultation process. As part of this process, FFA will continue its discussions with FIFA and the AFC. Now, the second point was FIFA was briefed by FFA on the commercial status of the game in Australia following the conclusion in December last year of the new broadcast rights agreement. And the third point is FFA briefed FIFA on the various football development activities it is currently undertaking in support of fellow member associations within the AFC. Now, the crucial thing for me in all of this is we have to go back to the Crawford Report. Now, the Crawford Report was to restructure the whole game. Now, the idea was it was to give stakeholders a say in how the game was run. Now, one of the things it said, it would give a voice to coaches, it would give a voice to referees, to futsal, to the A-League, and to every state body. Now, the big question is that everybody who's very close or looks at the politics of the sport has said, how often have these stakeholders actually ever met? Have they, in fact, ever had a meeting since the FFA was set up in 2004? And nobody has any record of a meeting of those particular bodies. Now, under the Crawford Report, he suggested that the A-League should always be run separately from the FFA and not run under the FFA. And that the idea when it was set up was the A-League clubs would have one vote because they were a separate organisation. So the FFA was still the overarching body to see football in Australia, but the A-League would be run separately. And that was why they only had one voice when it came to the running of the game in the whole of Australia, because that voice would be representative of all of the A-League clubs. Now, of course, it's changed because the FFA chose not to have the A-League run as a separate competition by separate management, and so they've only given all the A-League clubs one vote. And that is where one of the problems lies, is the A-League owners, who have all ploughing in tens, $20 million a year to support their clubs, are going, well, I want more of a voice than that one vote we have around the table, which means we're going back to the old NSL problem where a lot of the NSL clubs had more say than the state bodies. Now, the FFA should really be looking at the overall running of the game, whereas their focus has shifted far too much, in many people's opinion, to the A-League. Initially, it was the Socceroos to raise the profile of the game. Now, if you look at the television deal that has been set up, it has been built predominantly around the A-League. And this is why they do not really want to separate the two, because suddenly they've then got to find money to support all the programs away from the A-League, and also the Socceroos, the Matildas, all the junior teams, and all of those sorts of setups. So it's a fairly complicated issue. But the thing that I have a concern with, if you give the A-League's clubs more votes around the table, then it's going to skew it even more. The other problem that you have, and this is where I think the A-League clubs have maybe underestimated what's going to happen, is let's look at the state bodies. They all have a vote around the table. But who funds the state bodies? Or they, in a lot of cases, are puppets for the FFA. So they have gone along party lines in the past. I mean, if you look at the members who have a vote, there are 9 state bodies, 1 A-League body, and therefore you have a big issue there that the state league bodies can actually vote those off. But again, if you look at the structure of the Crawford Report, the way it was meant to work, and this is why it's so important, and I keep banging on about the standing committees and the zone reps in Western Australia and in all the other states, they are the ones who really represent grassroots football, who represent the clubs, who represent the players that play the game. And that's why they must be more actively involved, more professional in the way they go about their business in order, and by that I mean keep minutes, inform the clubs, talk to every club they represent on a regular basis, and then they go forward and put their thoughts. Now, I know for a fact, and I've spoken to standing committee members here in Western Australia before the AGM last year that was held, where Stephen Lowy got voted in as the new chair, and asked whether Football West's representatives spoke to the standing committees on any of the issues that were about to be raised at the AGM for the FFA, and whether they asked them which way they wanted to vote. They said they were never, ever consulted. Now, the way it was meant to work is they should have been consulted, and they should be demanding that they're consulted, so that whoever represents Football West goes there and represents the people of Western Australia. And that's what it actually says in the Constitution. I'm just trying to find, because I did write it down, but it said that their role is to represent the state bodies. That's it. It says they are there to give the opinion and report on football in that state. And that is in the FFA's constitution. Now, of course, what we saw when Stephen Lowy was elected was the FFA appointed a nominations committee, and they got rid of anybody they didn't want. And it's the same thing in Football West. They have a nominations committee to vet who's put forward for the board. And I know people that have not made it through that vetting system. I'm actually one of those. When I was put forward by somebody for the board several years ago, when questioned as to why, what, on what level I failed to make it through to the interview process, I was told they do not have to inform me on that. So again, you're having this. And the crazy thing is...
how you encourage people, isn't it?
Well, if you look at it, the FFA, they had 4 proposed people for the board, and lo and behold, all 4 got elected. And of course, one of those was Stephen Lowy, and he took over from his father as the chairman. Now, as Benita Merciades, when she came on this show, actually said, if that had been Zimbabwe or an African nation, or even probably, you know, a third world country in Central America,
Malaysia even,
we would have said, oh, corrupt nepotism at its worst.
Absolutely.
But because it's Australia, nobody has really said anything. Now, I think the question I have is this really going to help going forward? To me, it's a very ambiguous statement that the FFA have put out today when they say going to hold constructive discussions regarding the process of expanding the membership of its Congress in Australia, which would allow for broader representation of stakeholders. That's a very ambiguous statement. And the other thing I've been trying to find out, John, and this to me is because Football West is set up as all of the state bodies, as a PTY Limited. That's a proprietary limited company. So there should be an owner of it, or there should be stakeholders or whatever, so someone, or shareholders. Now, I've spoken to ASIC about this, and I said, well, who owns it? And they said, well, there isn't an owner. So I was like, well, I was told by a lawyer, because I sat down to try and nut through the sort of mire of legal speak and whatever. And so anyway, what we got to the end of it was that Football West must have one member who must have at least one share. So there's somebody. Now, all I can find is the first members, according to the Constitution, Stephen Kopac, Kevin Campbell and Russell Goodrich. So I'm presuming that they must be the three people who still, because the Constitution hasn't been changed, who are actually the three shareholders of Football West. So in truth, legally, are the only ones who can make real change.
Does that mean if Football West makes any money, it goes to them as a dividend?
I don't think they're allowed to, because it's still, I don't think it's a not-for-profit, but I don't think they can take anything out of it. I don't think they're entitled to any monies.
Now, I've got a couple of questions for you, because I'm not quite the constitutional lawyer that you seem to be, Ashley.
Oh, I'm far from a lawyer, and I am very grateful to the lawyers who've given me their time to actually try and make sense of it.
Now, who runs the Premier League? Is it the FA?
No, it's a separate organisation.
Okay, because I would have thought that when you're trying to set these things up, you look at best practice. And in a lot of respects, the English Premier League is the best league in the world for various reasons. You might make arguments that others are, but the Premier League's up there. They're obviously doing something right. So why aren't we just looking at how they've got it structured and go, oh, it works for them?
Well, this is what, John, and we've discussed this on the show a lot. The AFC wanted by this year, 2017, every single league in Asia to be run separately from the game's governing body. Now, the interesting thing is FIFA, which is, as we know, is not the best when it comes to actually the running or the structures of organisations. But what they're trying to do is clean up around the world and have a uniform setup. And the interesting thing is, yes, they've come to Australia and they're going, you need to do this, this and this. Now, Australia's an easy fix compared to some countries.
Oh, yeah.
But the idea is if they can get countries like Australia sorted out, it makes it easier then to go to the others, because they can say, well, look, we've got, of the 223, I think, nations it is under FIFA, we've got 190 that comply and do everything right. If you don't comply, you will no longer be a member of FIFA. And it just gives them that weight of numbers to cause them to change the way things are done. But the thing that worries me is that Australia is in that. Now, if you look at certain things that they were asked to do and they promised to do when they were bidding for the World Cup, the minute they didn't get the World Cup, as we've discussed again, those things that they promised FIFA they would do in this country went out the window. Didn't do them. I mean, one was the Aboriginal program, which has since got up again and is going thanks to John Moriarty and Warren Mundine, because they actually went out and found the money to fund that Aboriginal program. The FFA didn't.
Now, where's the future of Wellington Phoenix in this as well? I mean, they've just signed a long-term deal, was it last year, to stay in the A-League. There's pressure from the AFC to not have them in there. You know, how are they a sticking point in everything that's going on here?
I think that's a minor issue in a bigger one. I think the other thing that it refers to the last point there where it says FFA briefed FIFA on the various football development activities it is currently undertaking in support of fellow member associations within the AFC. Now, one of the things that was put in place there was that the Australian state bodies and the FFA would actually go into Asia and try and boost in some of the poorer nations, like say in Indonesia, and try and help them develop their football. Now, apart from the state team going to Indonesia a few years back, I'm not aware of much going on with FFA going there. I know that a lot of the clubs have had to, or coaches have had to go overseas because they can't get jobs in Australia. But I don't know. Obviously, there is something that they are doing in the AFC. But again, you have to look at their publicity department and say, well, you're not doing a very good job if we don't know what you're doing.
I always feel that football in this country is cursed by a misunderstanding of our sporting culture here in Australia and the size and the relative economics of sport in Australia, and looking up and trying to play with the big boys. And I mean, especially in the FFA's case, we're talking about a statutory body that's trying to run private interests, and there's always going to be major clashing of heads over what's best for, you know, people who are making money out of something are not always going to see it the same way as people that are, you know, trying to administer the sport. And they've got to separate them essentially, because the people who are trying to make money and grow the sport, the club owners, essentially they're trying to make themselves money and ergo they're never going to get a good run at it, while the people who are in the administrative positions, the FFA, the statutory positions, are making rules that actually go against their best interests.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And I think it has to happen. And I think the sooner it happens, football will be in a better way. Because the other reason is the exact reason the FFA do not want it to happen. Because they're going to lose that cash cow of the A-League being on the TV. And presumably when it moves away from that, it will be the A-League owners who negotiate with the TV stations to get the best deal for their league and their clubs. Now, the thing that worries me, and it has worried me for a long time, is, and we've seen plenty of people coming from other sports into football in Australia. If we look at Damien de Boon, who was the head of the A-League, came from cricket. We've seen Buckley came from, as the CEO, came from AFL. We saw John O'Neill came from rugby union. I think one of the biggest mistakes that football has made in the, 2004 to now, so 12 years that it has been the FFA, is they have not brought in a football person from overseas to run it. Somebody who actually has experience, as you said, from running in Europe. They brought in coaches. Yes, they've gone, let's bring in the Dutch coaches and they'll change our game. So they've accepted that they know best rather than Australian coaches. Some people would question that and whether the Dutch system is the best. That's an argument for another day. But I think it needs that, because what we've got is we've had people coming through the sport of football as a stepping stone to get the job they want in the bigger sports or the perceived bigger sports in Australia, being AFL, rugby league and cricket. They're going into football to get jobs in those sports. Also, I think the sport is paying too much money to people who do not have the experience or the know-how. And also, I think the big concern for me is they haven't brought in sponsorship dollars to support the game if the A-League moves away. If the A-League moves away, where is the money? And you're going to see everybody run for the doors in the FFA, because suddenly there is not the money. And the biggest problem is they're not funding grassroots. They're not bringing the money to look after the juniors.
Yeah, well, I'll mention that as we get to the second half of the show. Just before we go, though, I think I mentioned earlier, I'll look at the FA and see how they do the Premier League, and we'll just copy that. I'm going to contradict myself here, but we also, as I mentioned before, people don't understand the Australian sporting economy. And I think even sometimes Australian administrators, they get starry-eyed about these sort of things. Now, it's all very well and good for the FFA to turn around to FIFA and say, oh, yes, we'll have the FFA Cup knockout competition, or we're going to have a second division, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. But in Australia, it's not that easy. It's not like, oh, we'll just drive from Birmingham an hour down the road and we'll be in another major city with a huge base and, you know, all the, you know, that's what I'm talking about. Even those lower teams, lower grades and that, we just don't have a population base that supports that. You know, we don't have a Kalgoorlie FC where teams can do a tour and stop off there and then they go and play at Geraldton FC or something like that. No, it's completely different economic environment that we live in. And that's probably what the hardest thing, I think, administrators, they want all the bells and whistles of the FA, but we're never going to provide that. Not with the way our populations are structured at the moment. It's a couple of decades at least before we've got the numbers to start talking about those sort of things.
I agree 100% with you. The tyranny of distance here is just so restrictive. But I do think that if AFC was smart, and we've talked about FIFA having cross-border leagues, and they're trying that in a few European countries at the moment, and I do, I would be one who would support, say, Singapore, Malaysia and Indonesia. And maybe if we wanted to, Tahiti or Solomon Islands coming in. Now, I know you might think, oh, that's suddenly making the distance even greater because you've got to go to those places. But commercially, Asia has, as you said, John, the population. They have the big name companies and they would want that exposure. And vice versa, Australian companies would want the exposure in Asia because it's a big market for them to get a slice of the pie. And I do think that this is something that the FFA or even the A-League clubs have to look at down the track if they want to survive. Well, that is probably enough on the subject of football. We'd welcome your thoughts either by comments on Facebook or even via our website, which is notthefootyshow.com.
This is Floyd Mayweather Sr., and you are now listening to the Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are listening to Not the Footy Show. And that's another discussion for another day. Floyd Mayweather looking like he's going to take on Conor McGregor. But our next...
Cha-ching!
Yeah. Our next, or our only guest, in fact, on the podcast today is a man who really knows about overcoming adversity. We've had him on the show several times because he has broken a number of world rowing records. And, of course, Richard Wassell is a one-armed rower, having suffered a stroke when he was in the Navy. But he is now pleased to announce that he is heading to the Invictus Games. And it's with great pleasure we welcome back Richard Wassell. Richard Wassell, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me back there.
Well, you've certainly not been idle since we last spoke, and I think that was when you wrote me in your world record attempt down at Garden City Shopping Centre.
Yeah, that was a while ago now, and thank you very much for coming along and supporting me. It was fantastic.
And how many records did you end up breaking? Now, that was a 24-hour row.
Yeah, I broke three during the 24-hour period. I broke the first one, which was 100,000 metres, which I did in just over 10 hours. And then I broke the 24-hour record, obviously for 24 hours. And then I broke the continuous row record, which was 24 hours and 5 minutes, just to break another record.
And how did you pull up after that one?
I was pretty sore and then a bit sorry for myself, and my backside was like a cricket ball. It was sort of really red and bruised as well, and it was like that for about 4 weeks, so I couldn't actually sit down very well for a long time.
Well, I said you've been busy because you also went to the Pan Pacific Games, and was it the Masters Games, I think, where you were rowing there, and again had a very successful couple of days.
Yeah, I did better than expected, actually, because I'd been sick leading up to that event as well. But I entered four events and won four gold medals, so that was pretty good. And that sort of gave me a good lead in for the Invictus sort of stuff that I'm doing now.
Well, that's why we're talking to you, because obviously the Invictus Games now has become a really big event for ex-servicemen or current servicemen who've ended up with disabilities. And you've been selected for that, which must have been a really, really proud moment.
It's very proud, especially from a POM that's now rowing for Australia, I guess. But yeah, it's a very proud moment and very sort of humbling at the same time, because when I did go across to Canberra for the trials, there was a lot of people in a lot worse sort of condition than me as far as injuries and things are concerned. So I was very sort of humbled and very sort of honoured to be selected.
Can you remind some of our listeners who may not have heard your story as to what happened to you when you were in the Navy, weren't you?
Yeah, I was in the Navy, and in 1994 I was on HMS Evans, an Oberon-class submarine, just off the coast of Sydney, and I had a stroke. So I was just going along my business every day, and then all of a sudden I just fell over and I couldn't stand back up again. I was then airlifted to a hospital. I was in the hospital for nearly a year, and then since then I've been doing a little bit of running, and then eventually turned into sort of rowing, I guess.
Well, you've certainly made rowing, made your mark in the rowing world, but I believe there's only two events, though, in rowing at the Invictus Games, and you were telling me they're pretty tricky ones.
They are tricky because they're very difficult ones. They're done for time, so there's one for 1 minute and one for 4 minutes, and it's the person that does the most distance in that time. Obviously not consecutively, so there's a bit of a gap between the two. The 1 minute is just an all-out sprint, and you go as fast as you can and as hard as you can. But the 4 minutes, a lot more strategy involved in that as well. And usually after about 2 minutes, the wheels fall off, and it's just a real sort of struggle to finish that one.
And, I mean, is it separated like the Paralympics? For example, you know, you only have the use of one arm. I mean, will you be up against other guys with just one arm's use?
Yeah, it is classified for different sort of different disabilities and things. But I found out from one of the other guys that rode in the category I'll be in this time, that he was only missing half a finger, and he was in the same category as I'll be in, only got one arm. So I'm up against it, I guess.
Are you looking forward to the challenge? Because you're quite a competitor deep down.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to it. Not only sort of representing my country and sort of the honour of doing that, but also sort of competing and doing the best I can against myself, though. I don't care if I come last, as long as I do the best I possibly can.
Now, the other thing I noticed was you're actually doing running this time as well. You're not just doing the rowing, because I've seen pictures of you down at the athletics track herring around there.
I wouldn't say herring. That's a bit of an exaggeration. Yeah, because... Canada have only said we can, Australia can only supply 42 people this time around. A lot of people get doubled up into other sports as well. So, yeah, I've been selected to do the sprinting events as well, which is the 1, 2, and 400 metres. Again, that's just for a bit of fun, I guess. I don't think I'll be doing very well in those, but I'll try my best now. I've bought some running spikes, I've got a coach, so I'll see how I go.
Were you ever a sprinter?
I did pretty well in high school and in primary school, but that was a long, long time ago. I'm 51 soon, so it was a long time ago.
Now, the Invictus Games, you mentioned there are only 40-odd athletes going from Australia. How many people applied to be selected? Because I would think there would be a lot more.
Yeah, there was over 180 applicants initially. That was weeded down to 83 that went to the trials in Canberra for the week. And then from that, 50 were selected for the training squad. And then, from that, the next training camp, that we weeded out to 42.
Wow, so it's a pretty select group.
It's getting that way now. You know, the first one was just... some people, I was speaking to some people that went to the first when they were ordered to go. You know, they were on sick leave at the time, and they said, oh, you've been ordered to go to London to compete in the first Invictus Games. Nowadays, it's getting a lot more sort of competitive and a lot more... competitive, that's the only way I can describe it. You know, we've got a Paralympic champion in rowing in from Australia going as well, Curtis McGrath. He's pretty good. Fortunately, he's in a different category to me, so that's even better. Yeah, he says quite a lot of people now, and it is getting really competitive. So the some of the trials were very, very sort of hard fought.
Is that just the military way? Because we know a lot of people in the military are extremely competitive, or is it going slightly away from what the ideal of the Invictus Games was all about? Because to me, it struck me when it first started, a lot of it was about camaraderie and ex-military people being able to be amongst ex-military people with similar problems.
Yes and no. There is a competitive element to it that probably wasn't initially. You know, it was more about the camaraderie and sort of through sport and mateship, sort of recovering from some of the injuries and getting together as a military family again, I guess. Now, some of the countries, last time in Orlando, the Americans, Canadians and British in particular had some really competitive people there. So Australia have decided they're going to do a similar sort of thing. So we are going a little bit more. That's why the trials were set up in the first place. And then that's why we are getting a little more sort of competitive now.
You touched on there that people were ordered, I'm presuming, therefore they were still in the services. You're no longer in the services. How difficult is it for you to get time off work to go to the Pan Pacific Games and now to go to the Invictus Games? I mean, you must have a very understanding employer.
I do indeed, yes. By the time the games come around, I would have used all my leave and some besides as well. And then it's 3 weeks of a leave time as well. So my company, Trilogy Advertising Marketing, have been really, really supportive. And I've sort of said, just take whatever leave you need and we'll work something out when we get back.
That's fantastic. And I believe when you got back and you'd been selected, they even decorated your office?
They did. They decorated my office with a big... What do you call it?
It's a banner, isn't it?
It's like a big banner, yeah, big of Invictus things, and also a big couple of posts and things as well. So yeah, it's like I'm in Invictus sort of world at the moment. It's fantastic.
And there's only three athletes, you said, from WA going, so a very select group here.
Yeah, I didn't even know there was anybody else going from WA until I got to the trials, and then I found there was two others as well. So yeah, it is a very select group, and I found out that one of the guys from Rockingham went last time as a helper. He sort of ferried people around and things, but this time he's going as a competitor.
Well, that's pretty good when you consider how many people went for the trials. All three of you from WA all got selected.
It is. It's amazing, really. And it just goes to show, you know, that anybody can do anything if they put their mind to it, I guess.
Now, some people are going to ask, when are the games, and are they going to be televised? Are we going to be able to watch them, do you think?
They're in September, last week of September, the first week of October, I think the first 2 weeks of October. Last year they were televised on ESPN. I don't know what's going to happen over here, but the games after this is in Sydney, so I'm sure in Sydney there's going to be a lot more sort of television and media coverage as well, I guess.
Well, you've got a good family that have always supported you. They're not able to go with you. Are they just going to be having to watch on TV?
We've already started sort of saving to actually get money together for everybody to go. There is talk of having two. The Canadians have said we can put two people up in the hotel if the government, the military pay for flights over there. And there is talk that the military will be paying for two people to fly over there. But the rest of us, we're going to have to pay. So we're desperately sort of seeking funds at the moment. And the RSL, my local RSL, Riverton, have done really well. And they're actually doing some fundraising on my behalf at the moment.
Fantastic. If anyone did want to donate, are they able to help you out? I mean, there might be some companies listening.
For sure. I don't know how they're going to go about it, though, because we can't, as an Invictus athlete, we can't really do anything to fundraise on our behalf. So probably contact the Riverton RSL and go through there.
And that seems a logical thing. Well, Richard, brilliant to catch up with you, and hopefully we'll speak to you when you get back, and hopefully there'll be a few more medals to add to your collection.
Well, yeah, thank you very much for giving me the time once again, and yeah, all the best.
If you would like to donate to Richard's cause, you can contact us here at Not The Footy Show.
Hi, I'm Gordon Banks, and I'm listening to Not The Footy Show.
Yes, and that was Richard Wassell, and we wish him rather all the best when he heads over to the Invictus Games. And he is trying to raise some funds. If you want to go to GoFundMe and you type in his name, Richard Wassell, WASSEL, I think it's double L actually, you will find him on there. And if you want to donate and help him get across to the Invictus Games, please support him.
Now, actually, earlier you mentioned money filtering down to juniors. And it's not exactly that subject, but it certainly involves those points. During the week, I heard a bit of disturbing news. Now, Australia has a very rich and strong history in water polo. We've had success at it at Olympic Games. And it's always been one of those sports that, well, hasn't been what you call mainstream. Growing up, we knew we'd play water polo at school and etc. There was always water polo around. Of course, one of the most famous water polo matches in history was played in Melbourne with the Hungarian and Russian teams. And so there is a big link for Australia and water polo. Now, during the week, it emerged that the Victorian men's water polo team will not be competing in the national competition this year because they haven't got enough numbers. Now, sadly, under the terms of the franchise, what that means is the women's team will not be competing either because you need one from both sex to compete in the competition. It's an Olympic sport. Olympics have often, and for a long time now, recognised women as sports people. Now, it got me thinking, why is this the case? How did this happen? Obviously, the administrators who are in place at the moment aren't responsible for the fact that there's not enough depth and players in the men's game in Victoria to raise a team. But is it the responsibility of administrators of years past to have not recognised what has been going on in the sport? And what does it say for other sports who are on the margins in this country? Because traditionally, as far as I can remember, the guys had tended to gravitate towards being very, very good water polo players, usually were the same blokes that were good at football or rugby. They tended to be the tall, well-built, muscular gentlemen. Now, are these sports starting to lose out to the push by the majors, the rugby leagues, rugby unions and AFL footballs, to snatch up all the best athletes? Is it a case where their dominance is going to cause the demise of other sports?
It's a very difficult one. I think also there's an argument that you haven't thrown in there is how much water polo funding was cut because they didn't perform or get onto the medals at the Olympic Games. Is that one of the reasons, maybe, why?
Well, we talk about money filtering down from the top level to junior sport or to amateur sports. And let's face it, water polo is an amateur sport. Anybody who's competing in water polo in this country is probably not making a living out of it, even if they are getting money out of the government for competing, say they're in a WAIS program, or such as a WAIS program, AIS program. And is that it, as you say, if that's the consequence of, you know, performance-based funding, then we've got to seriously look at that, because you don't get better by cutting a sport's funding.
And as you've said in that thing, I think it's horrific to hear that the women are penalised because the men can't raise a team. I understand the reasoning behind it, but I think it's wrong.
I'm sure as they're sitting there looking at that, the people involved were making that deal on both sides, all sides would be going, oh, God, I wish we'd never done that. You know, but it's too late now. When they're the rules, you just got to go with them. And as you say, it's Olympic sport. It's understandable why you've got to have both.
But this is one of the things, and I wrote a piece on the website called Subsidising Youth, is the way forward. Because the Big Bash League, we've seen that's making lots of money. They're expanding the league now. They're going to play more games. But I was speaking to someone who wished to remain anonymous from the cricket fraternity, and they said, yeah, but none of that money is filtering down to the youth side of things. And this is what's happening. I alluded to it in the first half of the show with football. The money is not going down there. Now, in America, when I was there, I noticed that the PGA launched a thing called Youth on Course. And what they've done is there's over 300 golf courses in America that they've linked into, and no one between the age of 7 and 18 will pay more than $5 for a round of golf. So what they do is they give them a membership card. When they go into the club, if they have that membership card, they pay the $5, they pay. And what has happened is the PGA has gone out and got sponsorship, and they've got benefactors who have put money in to subsidise those young people playing golf. Now, what they were saying that it's done is they've noticed that it's really actually helped a lot of social issues by people playing, that some people are not team sport players, and therefore they would prefer to have a round of golf with just a mate or whatever. And so it's helped them. They also said it's seen now in the last year in America, they have more low 20 age group guys making the cuts later in tournaments now. So suddenly there's a new breed of player coming through because of this. And I'm not saying that this is necessarily the way to go, but you have to do something in this country to get more people playing sport. And at the moment, when you're charging in football, for example, $1,400 at some clubs for a junior to participate.
Yep.
That is too much. In cricket, I mean, again, I was talking to this person. They were saying, when you were growing up, I don't know if it was the same, but clubs used to supply a certain amount of kit.
Yeah.
And the schools provided. And they were saying now the kid has to have his kit or borrow it. That there is very little kit being supplied because the cost of the kit has gone up. Clubs are not getting the money to be able to supply the juniors. Or if they do, they have to go and find that money themselves to buy the kit to support the juniors. So instead, a lot of clubs have gone to mums and dads, well, you need to get him the kit because we can't afford to supply it. Now, that is not good. You know, that is not good for sport. If you want, and kids want to try different sports, they can't be going out buying football boots, cricket pads, ice hockey stuff. I mean, there's a limit to how much the average parent can afford.
Oh, absolutely, especially when you're talking about mainstream sports where kiddies are encouraged to play them, and a lot of kiddies want to. I know from experiences in my sport that the fastest growing segment is blokes my age and women over 40. That's the fastest growing area of our sport. And that should be shocking hockey authorities across the nation, across the world, if it's the same case. I don't know. I don't know about other countries, but certainly here. And you get really, really rubbery figures too out of sports bodies and organisations at times. They love picking the biggest number that they can possibly pick and spruik that. And I'm talking particularly about with the Big Bash recently. We saw the Perth Scorchers, you know, they said, oh, they've had 100 and whatever it is, 1,000 people at the WACA and so many sold out, etc., etc. But that's not unique individual users. And that's the new economy, is unique individual users. Of that 111,000, I would suspect that no more than 65,000 maybe were unique individual users. They've got 10 or 15,000 members. So how many of those people went to a game or all the games, or four of the five, or how many it was? And so we've got to be very careful where the administrators aren't hoodwinking us and leading us down a path to make themselves appear better, and you wake up one day and find out your sport's actually in real, real trouble.
Well, I'll give you an example of that. I mean, and I find this is a prime example of that. Now, Football West used to always report in their annual report the number of registered players. Last year, when they didn't hold the, in fact, they didn't hold an AGM in 2015, they held it in 2016. But in the 2015 report, suddenly they stated they had over 200,000 participants. Now, that I find interesting. So they've now come out and said they have 228,000 participants, but only 43,000 registered players. So you're like, well, where the hell are the rest of those players going?
And then that's 180,000 people, isn't it?
But then it's a lot. It's 18% are registered and the rest aren't.
What are they doing?
But then get this, John, on their website it says 154 countries, immigrants from 154 countries in Western Australia are playing football. And we're told that 185,000 originally come from the UK, 24,000 from Malaysia, 16,000 from China, 13,000 from Singapore, 12,000 from Ireland, and 10,000 from Indonesia. So from just six countries, six of those 154 countries that they're saying play football in WA, there are 260,000 participants in the game, yet they said there's only 228,000. So you talk about trying to hoodwink people with numbers. Football West can't even do the maths and get it right.
Yeah, and you know what? That is one of the biggest dangers to any sport, because, you know, if you're a player or you're a lover of the game, you just tend to believe that sort of stuff. You don't really go around and dig into it. And one day you will wake up and find your sport has just gone. Like the people in Victoria have just discovered that they don't have a water polo site anymore.
And a topic for another day, again, is the fact that we're seeing too many sports, in my opinion, fudging attendance figures in terms of giving away tickets. So what it's doing is it's saying, oh, we're in a really healthy position, because they're trying to compete against each other, but they're giving away so many free tickets. And I think the first sport that has the guts to say, you must declare on every home game how many free tickets you gave away and how many were used, then we will get reality, and then we can actually start budgeting and planning appropriately. And teams will not be in as much financial trouble as they are. Well, that's it for another podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please share your opinions with us, even if there is a topic you would like John and I to discuss. But we hope you like the new format, and we hope to catch up with you again very soon.
See you, Ash.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is.
See ya. We'll be back next week.